Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Zoom. Zoom is used by millions to connect face-to-face, across town or around the world. Zoom ties together all of your unified communication tools into one easy platform for video conferencing, phone calls, group chat, webinars, and conference rooms. Zoom is how business gets done. Visit Zoom online to set up your free account today. Meet happy with Zoom.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 28th of November, these are our main stories. There have been renewed demonstrations in Malta, where protesters are demanding the resignation of the Prime Minister over his handling of the murder of the anti-corruption journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia. Tens of thousands of people are again on the streets of Colombia, demanding a reversal of pension and tax reforms. And the authorities in Iran have arrested at least eight people who they say are linked to the American CIA in connection with recent street protests. Also in this podcast:
if the cows are happy, they'll give more milk and possibly better milk.
So if you have a cow, how can you improve its well-being? Simple. Give it a virtual reality headset. Protesters have again taken to the streets of the Maltese capital, Valletta, to demand the resignation of the Prime Minister, Joseph Muscat, over his handling of the murder of the journalist, Daphne Caruana Galizia. Protesters sat in the road on Wednesday near the Parliament building and chanted Muscat out. The opposition Nationalist Party earlier walked out of Parliament in Malta, berating Mr. Muscat for standing by his chief of staff, who resigned this week. Keith Schembri has been questioned by police about the murder in 2017. Maltese media say Jürgen Fenech, a businessman arrested on his yacht last week in connection with the case, has been rearrested, giving police another 48 hours to question him. Our correspondent Damian Grammaticus reports from Malta's capital, Valletta.
In front of Parliament in Valletta for two nights now, protesters have gathered bearing pictures of Daphne Caruana Galizia and signs saying no corruption. Ms. Caruana Galizia had been using her blog to expose shady dealing at the highest levels in Malta. She was killed by a car bomb 2 years ago. What's energised the protests was the arrest last week by police investigating her murder of one of Malta's richest businessmen, and now the questioning this week of the Prime Minister's chief of staff. Karine Vella is Daphne Caruana Galizia's sister.
The people are angry. I haven't seen anything like this for decades. You know, there is often anger at political rallies, but that goes at the tribalism of our politics. What we're seeing now is people being angry about issues, you know, without fear or favour. They don't really care who it is, they're just angry that something like this has happened.
Alongside the chief of staff, two ministers in Malta's government have stood down this week as police probe ties between the arrested businessman and those in power. So inside Parliament, the opposition walked out of the chamber. They and the murdered journalist's family are demanding that the island's prime minister must step aside. They say that is the only way to ensure a full investigation into the murder and a clean-up of corruption on Malta.
That was Damian Grammaticus in Malta. Tens of thousands of people in Colombia have been taking part in the latest demonstrations, calling for the reversal of unpopular government measures, including pension and tax reforms. Leonardo Rocha has more.
In Bogotá, Cali, Medellín and other Colombian cities, the marches have been largely peaceful, but there have been reports of isolated attacks on police officers by masked activists. The unions have declared a national strike, the second in a week, and most shops and schools have remained closed. Demonstrators are calling for changes to the economic policies of President Iván Duque, which they say will target the poorest in society and increase inequality. They're also demanding justice for an 18-year-old student, Dylan Cruz, who died on Monday after being shot by police during a protest.
That was Leonardo Rocha. The United Nations peacekeeping mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo is investigating whether its troops killed a demonstrator in the eastern city of Beni, where protesters burnt the town hall and UN buildings. Our Africa editor, Mary Harper, reports.
The UN mission MONUSCO said the protester was reportedly killed in an exchange with blue helmets as he was about to throw a petrol bomb. He died during demonstrations against what people said was the failure of UN forces and the Congolese army to protect them against rebel attacks. The latest attack occurred on Wednesday morning when 14 people were killed about 20 kilometres from Beni. Most of the deaths are blamed on the Islamist Allied Democratic Forces. The UN peacekeeping operation in the DRC is one of the biggest in the world, but it's made little headway against the multiple rebel groups operating in the east.
That was Mary Harper. Senior doctors in Zimbabwe have described the country's hospitals as a death trap and say drugs and equipment recently purchased by the government turned out to be unusable. In the last podcast, Shinga Nyoka in Harare was explaining that more senior staff have come out on strike in support of more than 400 of their junior colleagues who were sacked for taking industrial action. She's been meeting people at a major hospital in Harare.
Several families were sitting on the ground in the car park at Parirenyatwa, the country's largest hospital. I met one family waiting to collect a body from the morgue. They spoke to me on condition of anonymity, telling me that their cousin had died from kidney disease.
She was admitted over the weekend with an enlarged heart and kidneys. She was swollen from head to toe. There's no record that she was ever attended to by a doctor. They put her on oxygen. That was it. She didn't get the dialysis treatment because they needed a doctor's sign-off. The government needs to put politics aside on health matters. The sick should be attended to.
Her companion told me that this is the third family member to have died as a result of the strike. First it was her mother-in-law, then her uncle last week, and now this.
Saving lives should be the priority. In our neighborhood, we are recording so many funerals. It is devastating.
It's a desperate situation. Those needing medical attention don't know where to turn. I met a young pregnant woman who'd been severely assaulted by her husband. She had a huge gash above her left eye and could no longer feel her baby moving. She'd been turned away from one hospital because there were no doctors and was now trying her luck here, where she's heard that there were at least two doctors at work. The consultants and specialists who are standing in for junior doctors in the emergency wards have now withdrawn their services. They say that they have faced shortages of bandages, syringes and substandard equipment and that treating patients is no longer safe. They want the fired doctors reinstated. But the government, backed by a Labour court judgment, continues to sack doctors. 450 have been fired so far. Hundreds more, including senior doctors, still face disciplinary hearings. The government says it plans to recruit medical staff from other organizations and through an agreement with the Cuban government. Both sides are digging in a crisis some are describing as a silent genocide. There are no official figures showing how many people have died, but many more are likely to lose their lives as the standoff between government and doctors nears its third month.
That was Shinga Nyoka in Harare. Krupa Paddy spoke to Dr. Nyaguse, who's the president of the Senior Doctors Association in Zimbabwe.
We feel we're incapacitated to be able to deliver our duties, both financially and in terms of tools of the trade to use when we do get to work.
Incapacitated to do your duty, why?
One, in terms of the salary we're receiving. As you might know, the juniors have not been able to report for duty since September. So most senior doctors have continued to cover emergencies as best we can. But in the past 2 months, the employer has been withholding salaries for most senior doctors. So we have been coming to work at our own expense in order to give patients some kind of service. While we were in negotiations during that time, but the employer has then gone on to institute very punitive disciplinary measures against both the junior and the senior doctors. So we are no longer able to continue to offer that service.
And obviously we're talking about over 400 junior doctors who have been fired from their position for withdrawing their services. Talk me through, or give me an understanding of what it's been like for you as a senior doctor on a busy shift where you have people coming in and out of the hospital needing treatment. What's it been like? Describe those conditions.
the inflow of patient traffic has significantly reduced, because already before, when doctors were there full time, there were issues of lack of drugs and poor equipment, whereby the patient would get admitted and their relatives get given a long prescription, which they have to go buy at a private pharmacy, then bring the medication back. So already patients were reluctant to come. So this, the withdrawal of service then compounded that further.
Yes.
So the inflows have been reduced, but those, when patients do come in, obviously, one doctor is doing everything from the admission, taking of bloods, investigations, you know, preparing patients for theatre, doing the operation, post-operative care and the follow-up all by themselves. So it has been quite hectic. And all of that with without a salary for the past month, especially.
Dr. Nyaguse, the president of the Senior Doctors Association in Zimbabwe. Now to Saudi Arabia. Reforms in recent years have led to much publicised changes that have allowed women to drive and even attend football matches. There's also been a recent explosion of activity in the world of art, with the Saudi government promising to invest more than $60 billion in cultural programmes over the next decade. The BBC's Sylvia Smith has been finding out more.
At Art Dubai, the Gulf region's largest art fair, enthusiasts and collectors rub shoulders with artists and gallery owners. As well as towering sculptures of metal and marble and exotic-looking paintings, a mind-boggling psychedelic video installation combines Arabic letters with a rainbow of neon colours which flash on a huge screen. Mohammed Hafiz is co-founder of the Athar Gallery in Jeddah. He says Saudi contemporary art is starting to have an impact outside the kingdom.
Art is the window that people can see Saudi Arabia through.
At a workshop in the Saudi port city of Jeddah, I met the biggest foreign collector of Saudi art. Arnold Helb, the director of the Green Box Museum in Amsterdam, is acquiring a few new pieces to add to his already considerable collection.
The best way to buy them are from gallery holders that give long-term support to artists, that allow them to build a practice and help them printing books. That is the best way to do, I think, with buying Saudi art. Then sometimes they do appear at auction. In one or two cases, it was a charity auction, and the prices went very high. The most beneficial thing of that, it created kind of respect for the artist within Saudi Arabia, because people saw from, hey, this creates value, this is like an export product, and what our artists do gets respect abroad.
A relatively new and thriving segment of the Arab art market is modernist art. A group of artists from Saudi Arabia were among the first to shake off the Islamic label and seek a new modern identity. In the process, they interpreted everyday life through a new lens. Mirna Ayad is an art consultant.
There was speculation around the contemporary art market that it was sudden or it was new. People didn't know that actually there was a long and really rich history of modern art practice, and one which precedes the contemporary moment, and one which was really so beautiful. But it's so little documented and it's so little known, but more collectors are beginning to acquire such art, but also more institutions.
Nowadays, you can't help but notice the huge impact contemporary art is having on the Saudi modernization movement. Homegrown talent is influencing everything from advertising to shop design. One of the coolest places to work or just hang out is the old town of Jeddah, Al Balad, where traditional houses are being turned into galleries, shared art studios and design spaces for creatives. Hamza Serafi, head of the curatorial committee of the Saudi Arts Council, says it's crucial for a younger generation to develop a taste for contemporary artwork.
The most important thing is you are creating a young collector base. And this is a long process. It doesn't happen overnight. It happens through 5 to 10 years of working at it and promoting it.
It may take time, but as Saudi Arabia adds art to the school curriculum and young people view art as a potential future career, contemporary art will clearly start to play a more prominent role in shaping the social and political agenda in this rapidly evolving society.
Sylvia Smith reporting. Still to come in this podcast.
They spent $1 million on a cauldron that will hold the flame in the opening ceremony this weekend.
There are concerns regarding the preparations for the forthcoming Southeast Asian Games in the Philippines. Iran says at least 8 people linked to the US spy agency, the CIA, were arrested during the recent wave of street protests. Days of unrest broke out after the announcement of a steep rise in the price of petrol. Our Middle East analyst Alan Johnston reports.
The Iranian intelligence ministry said those arrested had received CIA-funded training in various countries. It said most were detained during what were described as riots, while allegedly carrying out the spy agency's orders to gather information. No evidence of any CIA link was presented. During the protests, banks, police stations and other buildings were set ablaze in many places, and human rights activists say more than 140 people were killed.
That was Alan Johnston. Hundreds of people have been killed by floods and mudslides as heavy rain continues to lash large parts of East and Central Africa. The once-in-a-decade weather phenomenon, the Indian Ocean Dipole or Indian Niño, is expected to bring more downpours in the coming days. In eastern Kenya, more than 120 are thought to have died. Around 40 people died in the Democratic Republic of Congo. In Djibouti, 9 were killed, including 6 children. Our correspondent in Kenya, Mercy Juma, managed to reach the village of Sibet in West Pokot.
Very little is left of Sibet, where once there was a village. Now there is just rubble, piles of earth and traumatized people. Mama Chimkan is in her 60s. She just managed to escape, but at a price.
I was running away when the waters were coming down. I fell and broke my leg and I have been in pain since then. My children carried me to this place. It is now that I have been attended to.
I am in a school that has just been converted into a rescue camp. Hundreds of people have gathered here, most of them women and children, and they say they have walked for days to get to this facility. Their homes and farms were completely destroyed by the floods and landslides.
Local officials told us at least 50 were killed in this region, but they expect the final number to be far higher. Identifying everyone will not be an easy task.
In some places, we have retrieved some bodies, which are some hands, some were legs, and it needs some forensic, maybe testing, so that we can know who they are.
Extreme weather patterns are causing devastation right across East Africa, although Western Kenya was hit harder than most. In these already remote parts of the country, the little infrastructure that existed has been destroyed. The only major road was cut off and bridges in some parts washed away. It has left aid trucks unable to get through. We came across one stuck in the mud. And with heavy rains set to continue, the need for the vital supplies they carry is only going to increase.
That report by Mercy Juma in Kenya. Here in Britain, one of the most influential cultural figures of the past 60 years, the writer, stage director and doctor, Sir Jonathan Miller, has died at the age of 85. He had Alzheimer's disease. Sir Jonathan made his name as part of the satirical 1960s show Beyond the Fringe, which also launched the careers of the actors Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and the author Alan Bennett. English National Opera said Sir Jonathan's contribution to the arts was immeasurable. The National Theatre called him legendary. The BBC described him as a creative genius. Our arts correspondent Rebecca Jones looks back at his life.
Jonathan Miller could have been a neurologist, were it not for Beyond the Fringe. In 1960, he was a newly qualified doctor when he joined the groundbreaking satirical review. It combined attacks on post-war Britain with more surreal moments, like Miller's thoughts on train lavatories.
Well, there's that marvellous unpunctuated motto over the lavatory saying, "Gentlemen, lift the seat."
The show's success was huge. It transferred from Edinburgh to London and then New York, and Miller's medical career never recovered. He went to work in television, directing an idiosyncratic acid trip version of Alice in Wonderland with John Gielgud as the Mock Turtle.
When we were little, we all went to school in the sea.
Soon he was directing plays as well.
If you prick us, do we not bleed?
Including Laurence Olivier as Shylock in The Merchant of Venice. And he became an internationally renowned opera director. His mafia-style production of Rigoletto for English National Opera remains in the repertoire after more than 30 years. Jonathan Miller often said he felt guilty abandoning his medical career and taking the easier option.
There are things about the sciences which it's difficult to do. You have to wrap a wet towel around your head to think out some of the things. Whereas in some awful way, it sounds like a sort of idle, arrogant boast, most of the things that I've done in the arts I can do with my right hand tied behind my back.
His versatility meant he was called a Renaissance man, a term he loathed. It also made him a figure of fun, with Private Eye satirising him as Dr. Jonathan, a sued, too clever by half. But he was a skillful director, governed by a simple philosophy, to remind the audience of what it is like to be alive.
That was Rebecca Jones. And the death has also been announced of the Australian writer and broadcaster Clive James. He was 80 and had been diagnosed with leukaemia nearly 10 years ago. Clive James came to the UK from Australia and deployed a wry, sharp wit throughout a prolific career as a critic, primetime television presenter, author and poet. We heard more from our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd.
Born in the suburbs of Sydney, I think suburbs is very important, in 1939, he was that generation of Australians like Germaine Greer who decided the way to get ahead was to move to Britain. Maybe in those days it was. In his 20s, he got himself a place at Cambridge University. From 1972, for a decade, he was the TV critic of the Sunday newspaper, The Observer. That was where he began to build a name. He was a wit, but more than that, he also made real critical points. Other journalists admired him, which I always think is a way of saying they envied him. He decided mainly to ignore the usual critical distinction between highbrow and lowbrow. Maybe it took a non-Brit to ignore the usual assumption that no one should do well in more than one area, because there were more than 40 books over the years, almost 50 in fact, from poetry to criticism to novels. He wrote and he recorded songs in the 70s. He published verse. He was a wordsmith, a very, very good one. And he always said that he tried to put his love of the English language at the heart of all of his work.
Television should be graced with as lavish a supply of words as you can manage in the space available. And they should be the words that remind the audience that the English language is a wonderful thing. It's the language that's the miracle.
And Vincent, he had been ill for a number of years, hadn't he?
Yes, I think in that recording, which was a few years ago, you could already begin to hear that he was having a slight problem with breathing. He died at 80, as you say, but he delighted in cheating death for almost a decade. He knew he was dying of a complex cancer. He was grateful for many years of treatment, which extended that life. He lived, I think, far longer than he ever expected to. And for some of it, he was remarkably well. And, of course, he wrote about the long process of dying with humour and with emotion, always that love of words. This is a small part of a poem he wrote, I think, about 5 years ago, when he knew very well he was ill. The poem's actually called Sentenced to Life, and though he was writing beneath the cold skies of East Anglia, Clive James recalled the brighter lights of New South Wales, where he'd grown up.
I watched the Pacific sunset, heaven sent, in glowing colours and in sharp relief, painting the white clouds when the day is spent, as if it were my will and testament, as if my first impressions were my last, and time had only made them more defined. Now I am weak. The sky is overcast here in the English autumn, but my mind basks in the light I never left behind.
And Vincent, there was a lot of sadness in the newsroom when we heard about him dying. Tell us about reaction. People have a lot of affection for him, don't they?
There was. I think lots and lots of journalists and others respected him. He was an intelligent guy, but when he did his lightweight stuff on TV, I'm not saying that in any negative way, he never spoke down to his guests. He was happy doing a cha-cha, you know, around the studio. And then he would talk about Philip Larkin. Tony Hall, the head of the BBC, he had a huge range of talents and everything he did was essential listening or viewing. Don't think many people would disagree with that.
That was Vincent Dowd on the Australian writer and broadcaster Clive James, who's died at the age of 80. Now to the exploration of outer space.
The European Space Agency is working to take humans beyond low Earth orbit and deeper into the cosmos. Our next destination on this journey is the Moon. The next destination will be unlike anywhere we have been before. The extreme and alien landscape of the lunar South Pole.
An excerpt from a video by the European Space Agency, or ESA, on its future plans to explore Earth's closest neighbour, the Moon. And as we heard in the earlier podcast, politicians meeting conveniently here on Earth, in southern Spain to be exact, are expected to commit to spending hundreds of millions of euros to fund new technology to support, among other things, a project to send humans back to the Moon. Ministers from the 22 member countries of the European Space Agency are discussing a request for more than 14 billion euros in funding over the next 5 years for a slew of projects. We got the latest from our science correspondent Jonathan Amos, who was in Seville for the ESA meeting.
Well, here they've got a sort of menu of things that the member states can spend the cash on. They're kind of bidding against each other on different projects. You know, they all have their own pet project. And then at the end of tomorrow, we'll have a full list of all of the projects and programs that will go forward. But some highlights for you. You mentioned the American missions to send people back to the moon. The Europeans want to be involved in that. They're making the propulsion unit for the American crew capsule, which is called Orion. So when the Americans go back in 2024 or shortly afterwards, it'll be a European equipment that pushes that capsule through space.
That was Jonathan Amos in Seville. The Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte has said that he's not pleased with preparations for the Southeast Asian Games. The event has been beset with problems ahead of the official opening on Saturday, with venues not yet complete and visiting teams left waiting at the airport. The organising committee has already apologised, as our Asia Hub editor Rebecca Henschke reports.
They were forced, after all these complaints, to come forward and say that they were sorry, although they really downplayed them, calling them inconveniences and miscoordination, and at the same time saying that most of the athletes were happy. But there has been a lot of wider criticism that they've had to face within the Philippine Senate about the mishandling of the budget after it was revealed that they spent $1 million on a cauldron that will hold the flame in the opening ceremony this weekend. So perhaps serious misuse of funds.
That was Rebecca Henschke. Virtual reality is something mostly associated with video games, but the technology has much broader applications than that. In northwest Russia, an experiment is underway to improve the lives of dairy cows. A farm outside Moscow is testing VR glasses for cattle in an effort to increase the quantity and quality of the milk produced. Vitaly Shevchenko from the BBC Monitoring Russian Service told us more about the research.
The announcement was made by the Moscow Ministry of Agriculture. It's not the Russian Ministry of Agriculture, it's the one for Moscow and the region, so it's official.
OK, so what do we know about this? Why do they need VR and why don't they just go outside?
The ministry says they want to improve the cow's emotional state, and there's also an economic reason behind it. If the cows are happy, they'll give more milk and possibly better milk. So farmers at one of the biggest farms outside Moscow got together with some IT specialists and altered existing virtual reality goggles, the ones that were made for humans, so that they fit a bovine head. And then they came up with a computer program that takes account of how cows see things. So what will they be seeing? Lovely, warm, green, undulating pastures and fields.
So why not just put them in undulating pastures and fields?
Well, land comes at a huge premium outside Moscow, so I'm afraid most of those cows will be spending their lives in bleak, grey, concrete buildings, not fields. So at least they'll have VR to see those. Is it working? Here's a quote from the Agriculture Ministry. They said, experts have established a decrease in anxiety levels and a general increase in the herd's emotional state. So apparently it is working.
Vitaly Shevchenko from the BBC Monitoring Russian Service. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. If you're an American, happy Thanksgiving. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye. Time to get back to the farmyard.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings towards your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings towards your family's ultimate vacation. Even five times the savings towards just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.